Good Monday morning, Spokane. My name's Taylor Weech. I'm your host this morning. You're listening to Praxis, a weekly public affairs show on KYRS. And I'm here with my guest, Van Nielsen.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
He's graciously helping me out because I'm incapacitated right now, but thankfully I can still talk. So we're going to be here the next 2 weeks, this week and next. When we started discussing this show, we realized it was a lot bigger than 1 week. So we're going to be talking about education, which is a favorite topic among almost everyone I know because it's something we were all compelled to go through since America has compulsory education. So we just started talking about the history. He's done a lot more reading on it than I have. So we're going to talk about some history, some kind of the reality of what public school is for those who have been outside of it for a while or who don't have children involved in it right now. And hopefully just illuminate some things. And then next week, we'll delve a little more into higher education and how those two interplay, what the role of higher education in our society is, and just kind of what the reality of the situation might be. Do you think that's an accurate? Did I get everything?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say K through 12 this week and college next week and how they play into each other, definitely.
Cool. So what was, you're from Cheney, right?
Yeah, correct.
And what was your K-12 experience all about?
Well, I, like most people, don't really remember much of my K-12 education beyond, usually the question you get is, what skills did you pick up? Well, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Well, did that take you 13 years to master? No. So what did you spend in your, doing in your school? Well, K-5, I'd say, I had goals of becoming objects that, were more or less non-attainable, like a professional quarterback.
Nice. But, you're not a professional quarterback right now?
No, unfortunately, I'm not a professional quarterback, nor am I Batman.
Mm.
Yeah, so.
So you got the basics.
Yeah.
But it didn't take 13 years to get the basics.
No, it didn't. But I always had this analytical mind, this internal questioning to... basically, I wanted to understand how I understand, but I didn't have the articulation, the language to bring those ideas out vocally. So like many people, when I hit middle school, I just became so frustrated in my adolescence that developed into aggression. And instead of coming out of that and mastering my own contradictions, I just essentially became, first... aggravated, and then just gave up and found the easiest way to skate through.
Mm-hmm. That's startlingly similar to mine. I went to elementary school in Spokane and was always smart, always tested really well, which is probably the reason that I got through school as easily as I did. Because what year did you graduate from high school?
2005.
Okay, so I'm 08, so we're kind of in the same era of super testing, where my class,
the WASL and things like that.
And my graduating class was the first to be required to pass the 4th grade, 7th grade, and 10th grade WASL.
Oh, geez.
So our advancement to the next grade was contingent upon us passing this test. Mm-hmm. And I was always great at passing tests. So it really fed into my mental perception of that was because I was smart and good. And people who didn't pass that test, must not have been as smart as me. But then I started to realize, later in elementary school and in middle school, when friends of mine who I thought were really smart, and I hung out with them and we talked about stuff and we played games and built stuff and, did lemonade stands and ran businesses together, they weren't passing these tests. And it kind of made me think, well, are they dumb? What's the deal? I started to be a little more critical about what was happening. And basically by high school, I'd come to the conclusion that most of what I was doing there was worthless and largely stopped going. But I was in a weird situation of being tracked. There's a lot of tracking in K-12.
Did you get Baccalaude?
No, I didn't. No, I meant tracking in the sense, there's two kinds of tracking, I guess. I meant in the sense that, you passed the test, so you get to be in the smart classes now. And,
right,
and
advanced
have,
AP.
Have access to honors and AP, and it's really an issue of access, because if you don't get in that door into honors at the beginning of 7th grade, your chances of doing so are diminished, and your internal willingness to do so is diminished too, because you've already been conditioned to think that you belong in the in the dumb classes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
the standard curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The normal becomes a bad word, you know? So yeah, that was basically my experience. And the part that you said about, not to ramble about this for too long, but what you said about it not taking 13 years to learn everything.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that was really frustrating for me, because I found in a lot of my high school classes that I felt that I had mastery over the material we were learning, and I was still forced to stay there. You know, there's no...
Right, there's no pass-fail system. There's no accurate level of measurement that would, you know, say, you've reached competency in these intellectual avenues, and therefore you are allowed to go, you know, either leave the institution and pursue individual pursuits or...
Mm-hmm. Or have
stick
a more
here with your peers.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it became about, you know, I went to school because my friends were there, not because
absolutely
I felt yeah. that I was having a great experience. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's the nutshell of mine. And so as we talked about this show, getting ready for it, we talked about teachers that we had talked to and other students. And I work with high school students now in a lot of ways. And there seemed to be a lot of common threads. So who did you talk to?
Well, I talked to a parent, an administrator, and a teacher. And it's important to note that all three of them, well, actually, with the exception of the administrator, who's actually my cousin, and he's in Iowa, so he's protected from his testimony.
Mm-hmm.
But the parent and teacher from the local area, they didn't want to be named for pressures. Mm-hmm. They felt, you know, the parent felt that her child, you know, they might catch wind of this treason and punish the child, you know, with the...
Hmm.
Declare
so were they
her socially
saying,
undesirable, perhaps, because hmm. she's at a level of competency in reading that is well above her peers.
Hmm. So what were they saying that was so dangerous and radical that they can't be named?
Well, I think it's the you know, basically there's only a few avenues that you have as a parent to approach the teacher about regarding problems with your with the students and the curriculum and the. And so you have the standard parent-teacher conference,
mm-hmm.
which parents are typically brought into the situation. It's usually in isolation. So nothing usually travels without the walls. And depending on your teacher, which there are good teachers, let's obviously establish that first.
Mm-hmm.
Good teachers, bad teachers, a lot of them will entertain your pleas and things like that and will turn around and just continue with what they were doing. So now, apparently, what's happening, according to a teacher that I talked to recently, is that there's parents now are just so aggravated with the outcome of the system that they are literally jumping over the teachers and going straight to the administrators. And this is taking up the time of the administrators, whereas they could be spending some of this time in the classrooms trying to weed out some of these, you know, these teachers who aren't paying attention to the child's development or individual, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So the administrators, is that what your administrator cousin said?
Yeah, they all pointed out several different things. The teacher mainly pointed out the animosity between administration and teachers, and the, you know, going over the authority of teachers to administrators, and that the lack of teachers actually have a lack of accessibility to any level of reform, actually. So they're shipped in these textbook curriculums, and the teacher will typically, you know, either they're going to go by this curriculum or they're going to try and supplement it to the best of their knowledge. But because we have the system of standardized testing, your child passes from, say, third to fourth grade and they get a totally different teacher, one that follows that maybe this teacher follows the curriculum to a T or doesn't at all. But the standardized test doesn't, you know, doesn't bring these variables into consideration, the complexities of human emotions and interactions between people. It's just uniformity, uniformity, uniformity. And when I asked the administrator, my cousin, who was a teacher and then became a principal of the school, I said, well, what kind of advocacy for reform, you know, would you promote? And he said, a free market education. He said the government shouldn't have a monopoly on education and that there should be a free market education. There should be schools that, pander to all kinds of interests and intellectual avenues and trades and things like this. And I said, isn't that jeopardizing to you, you know, your career and your employment? And he said, no, he's not worried about it.
Hmm.
So there are, you know, parents don't become too aggravated. There are good administrators. There are good teachers out there. They just feel that they have this lack of a voice.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also the class of administrators who have a deeply invested interest in protecting their job security. So
absolutely.
While he's concerned, you know, there's a lot of people who have a huge interest, a financial interest and otherwise, in continuing to have government controlled compulsory across the board uniform school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's, it's really interesting that there's a lot of like cognitive dissonance around the idea of educational goals, because even if you only listen to, say, Obama or the governor or government officials whose part of their job is to care about education, and in the state it's part of their constitutional mandate mm-hmm. to provide quality education, and the testing, there's a big push for, you know, results based, you know, like, are we getting results? And the results are supposedly measured by standardized tests, but then the goals, the stated goals, are college and career preparedness.
Yeah.
And the colleges mm-hmm. are coming back and telling K through 12, you're giving us students that all require remedial work.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the results that they're seeking through the testing aren't reaching the goals, the purported goals of career and college readiness. And I mean, people hiring say the same thing. Most people don't want to hire someone straight out of high school because they just have this concept that they're going to be ill-prepared, uneducated, and generally incompetent. You
right.
know?
You're going to have to hold their hand through all activities because they're just sitting there waiting for directions, as opposed to taking action for themselves and, you know, creating an incentive on their own.
Mm-hmm. So if that's not, you'd think, so when, how old is our compulsory education system in America?
In America, it officially came to Massachusetts in 1852. But I should also mention that there's a couple different levels of education. Like in early American history, prior to 1852, you had education that was promoting an independent livelihood. You know, you come here to the one-room schoolhouse to develop your intellectual capacities, but we know that you're going to go back because we're an agrarian society and you're going to work on your farm and you're going to have to know X, Y, and Z. But it was helpful for them to depend, you know, to create these businesses, independent businesses. So there was a lot of creation. There was a lot of imagination and inventiveness in early American history before this compulsory education system came in.
Hmm. So you'd think that after, let's see how my math is, I mean, 150 years of having a system like this, 160 years, that we'd have figured it out and figured out how to achieve the goals of college and career preparedness. So that kind of begs the question, like, you know, what are the real goals and why isn't it working? But maybe we're jumping the gun, because I know you have some more of the history, because I know before we talked, I didn't really know much of the history of the education system that I was part of, other than the really nice, I guess I recall a little bit in elementary school doing Washington State history and learning about the one-room schoolhouse. And
right. Eastern even has on their campus a one-room schoolhouse. But mm-hmm. a lot of their ideas are completely contrary to the ideology that was created, you know, to the rich intellectual history that came out of those schoolhouses.
Cool. So how did it all start? How did we get what we have now?
Well, first we probably should introduce to a lot of homeschoolers know this thinker, who's John Taylor Gatto.
Mm-hmm.
And he produced an incredible volume of literature titled The American Underground, or The Underground History of American Education. It's about as thick as a phone book, and it'll bring you from the 1850s, this import of the Prussian education system, to American shores. And it'll mm-hmm. give you a lot of background into a lot of the scientific forms of schooling and measurement that came into existence for the purpose of producing an industrial labor force, which was ultimately its goal. So.
Mm-hmm. So that's what we're working with, is what you're saying, is
yeah.
a system that builds an industrial labor force, not educated people.
We are. So mm-hmm. in the beginning, with the one-room schoolhouse you had, we're developing independent livelihoods. You had the import of this system we're producing, which around the same time as the Industrial Revolution, we're producing an industrial labor force. And then you all of a sudden have this transition into a post-industrial consumer-based economy. But at the same time, now it's all, okay, K through 12, instead of developing your individual capacities, instead of preparing you for the workforce, now we're just preparing you for entry to college. And this whole aspect of lifelong education, you know, this idea that you were in school for 13 years, now you're going for another four.
And then possibly another four after that.
Right. And you get a bachelor's and they tell you that, you know, the master's will give you higher employment because it's more specialized. It's the specialization of knowledge, which is actually, it's narrowing your language. So you have a lot of like idiot savants, essentially, people who can communicate highly technical language to you, but only in one frame.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, okay, tell me how it works in theories of human nature. Connect these ideas to, you know, social sciences and things like this, and they just stare, you know, blankly at you and go, no, sorry.
I'm only an economist. I don't know anything about...
Right. I can Band-Aid the system, but I can't tell you how it was created or what
or
purpose.
How it interacts with all the other systems.
Right. The famous who, what, where, when, why plus how method of, you know, investigating history or whatever, what have you. The why is essentially removed. And for a lot of reasons, they'll say, you know, why do you reinforce these myths K-12 of chopping down the cherry tree? Or, you know, like these kind of stories when you're like, well, tell kids about the early industrial, you know, revolution and how about child slavery trains and things like this. And they're like, no.
No, we don't talk about that because children can't handle it. And that's another thing about, he talks about this. I have part of Gatto's writing here that I was going to read too, but he kind of alludes to this whole concept of perpetual adolescence, like perpetual childhood through schooling. Because if you think about it, a lot of times this concept is vilified by people who think this was like a darker time. But really, adulthood came at 13 or 14 in the early times of our country. And people were already managing farms, you know, getting married and having their own lives at that age. And as we kind of developed this schooling system, we also developed a different idea of what childhood is and different psychological means to justifying having kids in school until they're 18 and extending the sort of the adulthood threshold to 18, which is now universally recognized in our country, I think, you know.
Absolutely. And when these public compulsory laws of public education came in the late 1800s, in the early 1900s came in a lot of child labor laws, which were actually worked, you know, you think child labor like, yeah, oh yeah, nobody wants a child slaving away at a machine for that long. But, you know, a lot of these children were, again, helping at home, helping raise the independent livelihood of their family and contributing to the community around them. And now it's, you know, you can't hit the job market until you're at X amount of age. Now there's compulsory education coming in. So it's keeping the child, when they start developing, like we said in earlier, that frustration, which if you don't learn how to articulate it, it'll turn into aggression, and then likely it'll transform into social anxieties that will just cripple you, you know.
Which is true. And if you look, I mean, 1 in 3, I think, adults in the U.S. have some kind of, like, anxiety disorder or something like that. And
typically surrounding authority.
Yeah, and it doesn't take much analysis to look back and say, what's the common thing that all of these people went through?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's school, you know. But that's a big, bad thing to say because we hold education in such high regard. You know, that's what we have this. It's part of the whole myth of American exceptionalism and we have the best schools and we do the best job educating children, even though the data shows that that's clearly not true. You know, even if you want to use our measurements, even if you want to do the test based cram information into your brain method, we're not even the best at that, you know?
No. And it's that transition from you had literary based learning earlier in American history. And then when this compulsory school system came in, it was a non-literary based pedagogy. So it was a scientific way of introducing all of this data to children without first giving them that process of how to learn and how to understand the process of understanding. So you can come to take all these different disciplines and connect them in a way that's, you know, will resonate in your experiences. So.
Basically. So that's something. So basically John Taylor Gatto, I think something he's most known for is this speech, Seven Lesson School Teacher, which he gave, I think he was receiving an award. Oh, yeah, he was being named New York State Teacher of the Year. And this is the speech that he gave, which I'm sure shook things up at the time. And continues to. He's a bad word in a lot of circles. You know, you don't mention his name. And the thing about him is, you kind of introduced me to his research. He has hundreds, I mean, dozens and hundreds of primary sources on this, saying, like, here are people who founded this system, saying very explicitly what their goals are. And their goals aren't whole people who can function as individuals in a society. You know, it's creating cogs for a machine. But so he says that the seven lessons that he teaches as a teacher are confusion. He says, the first lesson I teach is confusion. Everything I teach is out of context. I teach the unrelating of everything. I teach disconnections. I teach too much. The orbiting of planets, the law of large numbers, slavery, adjectives, architectural drawing, dance, gymnasium, choral singing, assemblies, surprise guests, fire drills, computer languages, parents' nights, staff development days, pull-out programs, guidance with strangers my students may never see again, standardized tests, age segregation unlike anything seen in the outside world. What do any of these things have to do with each other? He lists the other ones. The other lessons he teaches are class position. I teach that students must stay in the class where they belong. I don't know who decides my kids belong there, but that's not my business. Indifference is the third. The third lesson I teach is indifference. I teach children not to care too much about anything, even though they want to make it appear that they do. How I do this is very subtle. I do it by demanding that they become totally involved in my lessons, jumping up and down in their seats with anticipation, competing vigorously with each other for my favor. It's heartwarming when they do that. It impresses everyone, even me. That's another huge part of it, I think. The whole teacher's pet concept, just, and how that spirals out into adult life is insane. I mean, you can see people in the adult world and know that they were the kid jumping up and down for approval in school.
Absolutely.
And then the fourth is emotional dependency. Mm-hmm. By stars and red checks, smiles and frowns, prizes, honors, and disgraces, I teach kids to surrender their will to the predestinated chain of command. Rights may be granted or withheld by authority without appeal because rights do not exist inside a school. The fifth is intellectual dependency. Good students wait for a teacher to tell them what to do. This is the most important lesson of them all. We must wait for other people, better trained than ourselves, to make the meanings of our lives. The expert makes all the important choices. Only I, the teacher, can determine what my kids must study, or rather, only the people who pay me can make those decisions, which I then enforce. Sixth is provisional self-esteem. If you've ever tried to wrestle into line kids whose parents have convinced them to believe they'll be loved in spite of anything, you know how impossible it is to make self-confident spirits conform. Our world wouldn't survive a flood of confident people very long, so I teach that a kid's self-respect should depend on expert opinion. My kids are constantly evaluated and judged. Again, these are quotes from John Taylor Gatto, from his speech, The Seven Lessons School Teacher. And the seventh is one can't hide. The seventh lesson I teach is that one can't hide. I teach students that they are always watched, that each is under constant surveillance by me and my colleagues. There are no private spaces for children. There is no private time. Class change lasts exactly 300 seconds to keep promiscuous fraternization at low levels. Students are encouraged to tattle on each other or even to tattle on their own parents. I, of course, encourage parents to file reports about their own child's waywardness, too. A family trained to snitch on itself isn't likely to conceal any dangerous secrets. So that's parts of the speech that he gave receiving Teacher of the Year award.
What a shocker.
Yeah. So, and that was kind of cathartic, I suppose, for me to read, because I had seen all of those things develop in myself and my peers, you know, the confusion, dependency, frustration, you know, stemming from all of that, like you said. And when you think about it in those terms, even just briefly, the whole concept of school violence and this supposed the explosion of violence in schools begins to make a lot more sense, you know, because when you put people whose, you know, brains aren't fully developed into a situation like that, along with peers, you know, who also haven't learned how to act and how to interact positively with one another, it's kind of a dangerous situation by default, you know?
Oh yeah. Can be definitely.
So, yeah. What do you think then can be done about some of that? That's a big question. But how do we get more people to realize that that's the reality of a lot of our schooling, and how do you move past it?
Well, I think Gatto's an interesting example because he brings in this almost like this sociological perspective. He's taking this these theories of human nature and these social sciences and connecting them together in a way that you typically wouldn't even get through a college education nowadays, to be honest, where these are all fragmented pieces of knowledge. You have these puzzle pieces that are completely scattered. And it's I find it's better to articulate ideas in the history of ideas as opposed to this constant bombardment of trivia, which is what you get ultimately. And mm-hmm. So there are great teachers that connect these to you, but you shouldn't also be memorizing the connections of others, which is essentially what a textbook is. You read this historical analysis, they give you about 2 to 3 different lenses to put on, you know, here's a Marxist perspective, here's a feminist perspective, here's a this, you know, this perspective. And yeah, these are great perspectives to learn about, but you're memorizing someone else's connections rather than going and referencing these source materials, these primary texts, which ironically are available, readily available at research libraries. You can go to Eastern, you can check out their wealth of information on educational resources and look into these primary texts for yourself and say, okay, what is the nature, what is the form and function of the school system? What has effectively been removed? So focusing on the omission of curriculum as opposed to what's in curriculum. And definitely when you come up with your own solutions, you say, well, I don't want my kid in this anymore, this is wild, and they pull their child out or something like that. And then, but you shouldn't be looking to emulate that exact same system.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard because for generations and generations, that's what people have been in, and that's what you've learned that learning is.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Even when I came out of high school, having been frustrated by high school, barely graduating, you know, not participating to a high degree, and then went straight into working with young people, and I found myself, it took me a little while to realize it, but I found myself emulating the behavior that I had resented in school to a certain degree. And what unlocked it was you can't behave like that to your peers when you're a young person, because they'll call you out on it and they'll say, you know, who do you think you are? How can you can't treat me this way. And I didn't even realize that it was that I was oppressing others by doing that until it was pointed out to me. And then I realized, wow, we need to find a completely different way to do it. And what we ended up doing was just stepping back and saying, what do we want to do? We did what we wanted. We designed things using methods of our own creation and got a lot done. And people were shocked. And they're like, what's your secret? How did you do it? It's like, I listened to kids, you know?
Right.
We listened to each other and came up with something unique. You know, we didn't ask experts how to do it. And we didn't do any of that. It just happened because we knew how to do it already.
Absolutely. It's that inquiry that's developed at that stage of adolescence. Everyone hits middle school and they just become so frustrated, like I said. And they just literally become so frustrated that they push these forms into aggression because they say, I can't escape this. There's no way I can make an independent livelihood for myself. Not even that they have that language to articulate those frustrations to begin with. So, you know, it shouldn't come to any surprise that a lot of America's early inventors and creative
scientists
spirits were at age 13, 14, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming out at that stage of adolescence because they had that revival. They had that inquiry, right? And instead of suppressing it, which perpetual adolescence will bring you through, they learned how to cultivate those and they became proficient speakers and writers and active literacies and things like this that really helped them communicate their ideas to others around them that improved the wealth of the community that surrounded them.
Mm-hmm. And it's whenever that's even taught. So we learn about Einstein, obviously, in elementary, middle school. And it's, I think for me, it was mentioned that, and he dropped out of high school, but it's always presented as an anomaly. He dropped out of high school, but he was a success anyway, like despite that barrier, rather than stepping back and saying, and look at all these other people who dropped out of school and went on to do great things. I wonder why that is. You know, they definitely don't allow you to get to that point. You know, it's usually mentioned in passing, oh, he didn't go to school. He must have been really smart. You're not that smart, so you have to stay in school and learn about it.
Yeah,
it's kind of the message that ends up being delivered.
Right. It's not that you hit that stage of development and automatically you're just, boom, oh, I'm smart. I've developed all these capacities. No, it's that inquiry that drives you to retain your imagination and your inspiration and to contribute to those around you. Mm-hmm. And that, unfortunately, is driven into the ground, which is why a lot of students, when they get to high school and they walk in grade 9, they just go, oh, my God, I can't wait until I get out of here.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of always how it's presented, you know, whether it's waiting for the bell to ring
mm-hmm.
or waiting for the big bell of graduation to ring, you know, you're kind of in limbo the whole time, just waiting and waiting and knowing that it's going to be over, not really being present because of that, you know,
mm-hmm.
most kids certainly aren't present. And then that, you know, gets pinned back on kids again and saying, well, it's these kids' fault. We need to drug them because they can't pay attention. And that, to me, is one of the biggest moral wrongdoings of the last 50 years, you know. And moral wrongdoings abound in the last 50 years of our country.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I think the systematic drugging of school children is a pretty big, gnarly one. And it's impressive, and it's a testament to a system like this that so many parents go along with it and are willing to accept. Like, yes, there must be something wrong with my child. I will, you know, give them strong drugs. I mean, Ritalin's not aspirin, you know.
It has
serious effects. It's, you know, an amphetamine.
Yeah, my child has ADD. And then going back to what Gatto said in this first lesson, I teach the disconnection of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I bombard them with all these random subjects, and you have a bell that goes off, which is conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
So the child's just looking at the bell, waiting for the bell to ring. Their internal clock is already sequenced to the bell. And they're reading a poem, and then they just drop that poem and put on their math hat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, now we're doing math. Okay, am I retaining any of this knowledge? Am I understanding math instead of connecting to, you know, like things that might jazz things up, like the history of math or these connections? It's all this compartmentalization.
Or let's apply some math, you know, let's mm-hmm. build something. That's the only place I like to tell people, the only place I learned any real good, useful math in high school or in any school, past learning basic arithmetic, which took me, you know, 3 months probably total, was in stagecraft and learning to build sets. How are we going to build stairs that are circular? I guess we need to learn some geometry, you know? And we did, and they worked, and it was so much more satisfying to, instead of having a paper full of formulas and stuff, have that, but also have, you know, a full-size, like, house, basically, that you built with your peers. There's one teacher, and he wasn't there to give all the guidance, so we were let loose with power tools and math and built all kinds of, you know, award-winning stuff. So for more of school to be like that, I think, is key. You know, just to have an actual experience during which, you know, you learn teamwork, you learn math, you learn a lot of art, you learn mechanical skills, and that's one class, you know. But it was at 7 a.m.
yeah,
kind
zero
of limiting,
hour, right?
Limiting yeah. participation, yeah.
Yeah, limiting who the heck wants to wake up at, you know,
mm-hmm.
7 o'clock in the morning when you have to wake up, and then you have to go through, what, 7 hours after that where you're just, again, staring at that clock?
Mm-hmm. Or 8. So
yeah, or 8 after school activities.
Mm-hmm.
Like these parents are a lot, and I don't want to blame parents or anything, but these parents are coming in and they're saying, you're leaving this out of the curriculum. Like, do you really want to keep your child in here for more than 7 hours a day? Like, you should probably be supplementing some of this. It
mm-hmm.
isn't the total responsibility of the institution to provide all of this to children. Like we said, those books, those primary source books, are available to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can go and pick up these texts. And if you're more of an academic learner and that helps you, that's great. If you're more of a hands-on learner, you don't have to approach the expert or the, you know, the institutional captain of mm-hmm. this division of learning.
Mm-hmm.
You can go and find Joe Schmo down the street or what have you, who's been a mechanic for 50 years and say, show me how this car works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you're not accredited.
Mm-hmm. There's a story in the intro of this Gatto book, Dumbing Us Down, that the man writing the introduction, I don't remember his name, he talks about his father, who was a teacher for over 50 years and just had a passion for teaching in the true sense of, you know, like igniting someone else's potential.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also a plumber. And he went to a school when he was in his 50s or 60s and said, hey, can I come in and teach your kids about plumbing? Can I teach them about it and just show them how it works? And the administrator was just baffled. It was a principal or a teacher and just said, why would we do that? And he's like, well, they'd learn about where their water comes from and what the mechanics of, you know, items they use every day are and where their water goes afterwards. They'll be learning about the environment. They'll be learning about a trade. You know, they'll be learning hands-on skills. And he was just turned away with like utter bafflement of like, why would we want kids to do that? That's bizarre. Career days next week.
Right. And I would argue that, you know, why would you subject your student or your child to another 4 years of education after going through 13 years of education and saying, here, you should learn from this guy who's literally been in the system as many years as you have, and his first opportunity of employment is back in the institution. And these are supposedly experts who are supposed to be teaching us real life job experience. We're preparing you for the workforce.
Mm-hmm. It turns into this kind of cycle of continuation, you know, because a lot of people, I wanted to be a teacher when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went through school and decided, forget about that. I can't hack it. And a lot of my favorite teachers in high school would, in confidence, you know, tell me, don't get into this. Because I do, you know, you might love it and I love things about it, but it's nearly impossible to do it with any freedom. And I guess they do it for the snippets they still get, you know, and they must get a lot of satisfaction out of teaching kids, because otherwise, why would anyone do it? You know, for the teachers to be blamed, as they often are, in arguments, you know, it's these bad teachers. I think that's horribly inaccurate, you know, because a lot of them are, you're not in teaching for the money, you know.
Right. They're provided the curriculum. They're provided the state standards and federal standards for determining the outcome and the measurement of children, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have, I think what it ultimately boils down to is this education versus social indoctrination. Education is an instructive or enlightening experience. Whereas you go to school, why do you go to school? Well, first of all, what is a school? You know, it's a division of an educational institution consisting of, you know, various grades and classes. So it's all these various compartments. And well, why do you go to school? Oh, I go to school to learn. Well, if you think of learning in the aspect of what most people tell you, well, I go to school for, you know, what, reading, writing, arithmetic, things like this, to develop basic skills that will help me later in life. Well, if you think of it in the psychology aspect, learning would be behavior modification, especially through the experience and conditioning. So it's literally a process of social indoctrination. We want to produce competent citizens that will be effective producers and consumers. Now that the production is gone in this country,
mm-hmm.
there is no industry, yet we're still using the industrial model of schooling, things have shifted to consumption. And largely to the consumption of not ideas and connecting of ideas, but the trivia aspect again,
mm-hmm.
the compartmentalization. So you have people that are going in, yeah, right, for this whole, I'm going to school for this enlightening experience. Well, why was my imagination destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you might want to develop a more broader language that crosses all disciplines to help you articulate that.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, like you said about being post-industrial, you don't need even a K-12 education to be a clerk at Walmart or the grocery store or to do a lot of service industry jobs, which is what we have now. You know, we have the service industry, you can work for the government, you can work, you have that list, don't you? Were you looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics?
Yeah, the other day I was looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and I read a report called the Top 30 Occupations in Growth for 2010 to 2020. And in those top occupations were retail, food service, customer service, and office clerks, and in-home caregiving. And the level of education for entry into these professions was high school or less. Or less.
And yet, we just heard, last month, both Obama and Mitt Romney saying all of these wonderful words about how important it is that everyone go to college and everyone have access to college. And that's still a huge part. It's becoming less so. I've found in the last 4 years since I've graduated from high school that I've not been in college. When I first graduated, people were thought it was outrageous. Like, why aren't you going to college? You're shooting yourself in the foot. Your whole life is going to suck because you're not going to college. And now I think like that the economy's gone downhill a little more, and it's becoming more and more apparent to people that like, oh, there's no jobs in demand that require college. Why am I saddling myself with debt just to go back and work at Macy's, you know?
Right.
And now people are starting to be like, oh, maybe you weren't so horribly wrong after all. But I mean, for that to be the rhetoric that we're still hearing from our expert leaders, is kind of disappointing to me. Well, I guess we'll talk about higher ed next week, but
yeah, I know, right? We're jumping.
It all ties together, you know, but
oh, it definitely does. Mm-hmm. It definitely does.
So how did all of this behavioral psychology, stuff become the substance of our education system?
Well, a lot of historians attribute this import of the Prussian education system to a statesman by the name of Horace Mann, a Massachusetts statesman who became, he was basically a Congress member of Massachusetts who then became an elected senator. And then after that, in 1837, Mann was appointed the secretary of the newly created Massachusetts Board of Education. So, and he was one of America's first and foremost educational reformers. Well, I guess you could obviously take it back to the one-room schoolhouse, but we're focusing now on the industrial system.
Mm-hmm.
So Mann comes in, and he's on this board of education, and he's sent out to investigate these different systems in Europe to see, you know, maybe there's a different method of training that we can bring to America to improve efficiency, essentially. So he goes over to Prussia and settles on this and says, oh, interesting. And like, so in the early 1800s, Prussia is being beat to crap by France. And then France is pushed out. And a lot of people who are familiar with philosophy can connect the idea of strengthening this unity in Prussia to Johann Fichte's Address to the German Nations, which was the development of this idea of developing a single will of the state as opposed to cultivating individual will. So it was to create a stronger and military society.
Mm-hmm.
And but it produced really efficient and obedient workers to, you know, industrial and educational authorities. So a couple of generals in the Prussian army brought over this man by the name of Wilhelm von Humboldt, who became the first Prussian education minister. And Humboldt and Fichte, because Humboldt was inspired by Fichte's address, but Humboldt and Fichte owe their ideas to this man by the name of Johann Pestalozzi, who was this Swiss pedagogue, and he believed in the science of education for the purposes of socialization, as again to, in, you know, cultivating independent livelihoods and things like this. So they're really getting into the scientific form of schooling. And what Pestalozzi's ideology was, which still is in existence today, was developing non-literary experience-based pedagogies in primary education. So focusing less on the literary aspect, focusing more on the individual and physical development, the scientific and like psychological approach to schooling. So Mann eventually, he writes these papers, says, wow, what a great system, comes back, starts distributing them all over the place. They go to all different kinds of states. 1852 rolls around, and Massachusetts adopts the first compulsory schooling laws. And were people receptive to this? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. They weren't. There was a literacy rate of 98% in 1850.
In America?
Yeah. Yeah, well, in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And you fast forward to 1980, Massachusetts literacy levels, it's 91%. So over several years, has this system really improved anything? That's a question, you know, people should be asking themselves. But basically, yeah, people were not very excited about surrendering their children from the agrarian society to the industrial labor force. And again, in the early 1900s, when those child labor laws came in, it really started forcing kids even more into school. So about the 1900s, pretty much all states in the United States start picking up this industrial system. And there's a really good quote from Theodore Roosevelt in 1909. And he says, quote, "We want one class of persons to have a liberal education, and we want another class of persons, a very much larger class of necessity in every society, to forego the privilege of liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks."
Wow. And was that Roosevelt or?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So you have this.
So it's a very overt.
Yeah.
This is to create separate classes.
Exactly. And a lot of these, the first PhDs were trained in Prussia. They were coming over to man these, what we would consider prestigious institutions like Yale and Brown and Harvard and things like this. But it was for the purpose of creating a managerial class. So, which is kind of the way Theodore Roosevelt divides it. You know, you have a managerial class and you have a labor force.
Mm-hmm.
Some of you will have the liberal education. Some of you will be producers of individual capital and things like this. Others, you're just, I'm sorry, but you're just going to have to work for somebody else for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. So creating employees. And how did they start the tracking of people into those two classes? Was it based on what class your family was already part of?
A lot of it, yeah, had to do with economic powers.
I guess definitely. That's still true. Like, if you want to go to private school, you're going to pay.
Right, yeah.
You know?
You're going to pay.
So if your parents have the ability to pay, then you're allowed that more elite education.
Absolutely. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that these wealthy industrialists like Rockefeller, Carnegie, Ford start putting a lot of money into funding public education to produce more efficiency to their factory systems. And so by the early, like I said, by the early 1900s, you had these PhDs coming in from Prussia, training for the managerial class to create a competent and industrial efficiency behavioral psychology form of schooling.
Dang. Wow. So, and now still, I mean, if you look at who funds a lot of education and a lot of supplementary education programs, it's still the Carnegie Foundation, John D. Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation. I know, I mean, there's a lot of grants that still come out from
Bill
them.
And Melinda Gates Foundation, mm-hmm. who and, ironically was not a college
yeah.
graduate himself.
Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting that it has ties that obvious that I never really thought to, I never even, you know, step back to think, I wonder why the Carnegie Foundation, I wonder why Carnegie would be so interested in education. And that makes a lot of sense, you know, ensure a labor force forever. That's a good reason to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. There were also a few other prominent figures that people should look into, like Frederick Taylor, who was known as the father of scientific management. He was employed by these wealthy industrialists to increase this industrial efficiency. And a man by the name of Morris Cook adopted these ideas and transitioned them to the academic setting. So, and ironically, he was under the employment of Carnegie again. So there he pops up again, and that's where we get our credit hour system of measuring achievement, which is a very industrial, if you think about it, you know. The bell rings. You have a certain credit hour system. You get the 10 to 12 week survey course
mm-hmm.
without having much depth.
Mm-hmm. And it assumes that it takes the same amount of time for each person to learn the material. You know, this is the amount of time. And if it didn't work, then you failed, basically. And if it worked sooner, you're still required to pay for and sit through the total, you know, of the classes. And I remember when I got to the difficult time of middle school, you know, when I started to be a little more rebellious, I began to ask a lot of my teachers, you know, can I take the test now and not come to class afterwards? And I was like, ha ha ha, that's ridiculous. But if the point is to master the topics at hand, and if it's something I've already learned on my own, you know, through reading, or that I just understand naturally, is it that outrageous for me to move on? You know, and it really, they turn it, oftentimes it's turned around onto, well, you wouldn't want to do that to your peers. That might make other people feel bad.
Right. Social, it's reward and discipline. It's mm-hmm. a social approval and social disapproval. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't want to stick out like a sore thumb. Like I said, I just coasted that mm-hmm. 3.25 average for entry to colleges. Just maintain that. Stay in the gray area. Don't mm-hmm. become, you know, too noticeable to social circles and academic circles.
Hmm. Yeah, that's definitely a school lesson. I mean, I had that really deeply illustrated for me my junior year of high school. I was taking two AP classes, English language, and U.S. history. both of which I read the material. I was really interested in it. I got to do a lot of that like primary source type of stuff. And it was all geared towards taking the AP test, which I did. I didn't do a lot of the homework in those classes. I ended up failing both classes. Like non-completion, fail, F. You cannot graduate without those credits. Meanwhile, I took the AP tests and got fives on both of them, which is the highest score you can get, earning like 20 college credits for that. So I got college credit for a high school class, which I failed. So then I end up in summer school after junior year, and they give me the list of everything I need to complete to have completed junior English and junior history. And I realized then, oh, I don't have to stay for all 3 months of summer school if I just get all of this done. So I completed both classes in 5 days, turned in all the material, and the summer school teacher was just laughing. She's like, what are you doing in summer school? I said, well, you know, if you'd let me do this in the first place, I could be doing all kinds of things right now. You know, I could be done with school, and so could a lot of people, I think, if it was more individualized in terms of pace also.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. And you don't have to emulate that system. You know, you don't have to say, okay, like we said, you switch up the order. Okay, well, they learn this in the ABC format, and all you can think to do is put it in BCA or CBA or CBA. You know, like it's not that you have to start shuffling these. It has to do with that difference between education and social indoctrination, which ironically, most kids, when they reach that stage of adolescence, they've already figured it out, whether they have the language to articulate it or not. They figured it out. They go, yeah, I'm fairly competent in, you know, how to live and function in this society. Okay, well, you need to, you know, you need to stay here several more years. Mm-hmm. And then you need to go to college, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's perpetuating that the stage of development where children are really supposed to be reviving that imagination and putting it to effective use.
Mm-hmm. That's when a lot of good things happen, is at adolescence. That's when a lot of people's brains kind of switch on at a new level, and creativity is abundant. If you look at the difference between self-expression in elementary school and self-expression in middle school, it's really easy to see it. Elementary school, everyone dresses a lot more similarly for the most part. I notice this. And then in middle school, you get all of this huge social variance of all of a sudden people are dyeing their hair and wearing more confrontational clothing and having a lot of different types of expression. I don't know if that's a rebellion against the system that they're realizing exists or if it's something developmentally.
I would say it's probably a little bit of both, but it's definitely that rebellious stage. And that's ultimately where, you know, there are a lot of good middle school teachers. And Gatto was a middle school teacher, and he was lucky to get kids at that age where he could help them. They were so frustrated with the system at large, and they got to that stage where they just became aggressive in their behaviors. But he said, hey, you know, you have enormous potential. We'll figure out what you're competent in. I'll help you develop certain lesson plans that, you know, interest you and things like that. And it doesn't necessarily have to be modeled around an emulation of the current system. In fact, a lot of his kids were totally absent from the curriculum because he sent them out on projects and they were gone for a month. And he got tremendous heat from administration saying, what are you doing?
But he also won Teacher of the Year.
Yeah, but he won Teacher of the Year, and it was the publication of that essay that won him credibility and started pushing him around the globe to deliver speeches.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so ironically, talking about eighth grade, talking about middle school, that's been the focus locally. I've been able to witness this debate and this whole, so, you know, they've been doing studies. It turns out they're doing a lot of studies on my class. I didn't know this when I was in high school, the class of 2008. Only, let's see, 42% of my class was non-completion for high school. So either that means they dropped out, they transferred and didn't report it, or didn't collect all of their credits. So it's a third of kids. You saw all the billboards. There's a big campaign, 1 in 3, 1 in 3.
Yeah, this is 1 in 3.
This is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, there were some people talking about systemic changes and some talk about that, but it was very surface level. And a lot of it, unfortunately, came back to what's wrong with these kids? Why can't these kids graduate? And that's really frustrating for me. Or it comes back to the teachers. The teachers aren't doing it, when it's clearly not either of those. So now what they've found, they spent millions of dollars. Like, I think it was like a $2 million study done locally that found that eighth grade is a turning point. Something happens in middle school, and we can catch these kids in middle school, and we can change their outcomes using the same system that doesn't work for middle school age children. So that is something that they're working on now. They also developed an early warning system so that now we can know by fourth grade whether or not a student's going to drop out, which I think it's interesting data. It's interesting from a purely scientific perspective, but you are still putting kids into a class system. I mean, you're still enforcing, you're still using the same method that doesn't work. It would be great science if it wasn't experimented on live children, you know, who could probably be served by a better system. But I just think that's really interesting. And whenever I try to bring that up in these conversations, it's kind of not addressed in a lot of cases. Or it's like, well, you're so young. You don't really know. You're not really an expert. It's like, I just came out of 13 years of being immersed in this system. And if that doesn't make me an expert, I don't know what does, you know.
Right. You're an expert. You have a career of schooling.
Yeah. That's almost all of the work I've done ever. And you, you know.
Oh, yeah. I'm fresh out. I got the bachelor's.
Good. Do you have a job? You do. You do have a job,
too. Yeah, I clean apartments.
Yeah. And college isn't always bad, you know. Education certainly isn't bad. I don't want to come across as saying that. But school, I'm not very convinced on, especially having talked to you and done it a little more. So, yeah. What else? I mean, what else is there? There's a lot. But we've got about 2 minutes left. What are your kind of, since we're mostly just talking about K-12 this week, what are your kind of final thoughts on that?
I would offer maybe a little bit of advice, and again, it's not really my place other than being a former student myself, but saying that you've just got to start supplementing your education. You can't let this system destroy your incentive and your imagination and your inquiry, that internal dialogue that you have within yourself that's going to produce new ideas and connect historic ideas together, not memorizing other people's connections, but making them on your own. So like we said earlier, you have that wealth of primary source information. You can go access it yourself if you want to go the academic route. And there's tons of teachers around every single corner. They might not be accredited to the institution of state compulsory education, but anybody can be a teacher, because that's what real education is. It's an enlightening experience.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Very well said. This has been Praxis, talking with Van Nielsen. We'll be back next week also talking about education, compulsory education. I guess in the case of college and higher ed, it's voluntary. Sort of.
Sort of.
And we'll talk about that, how it's sort of voluntary, how it interplays with this whole social modification system that is K-12, and what you can do about it. Does that sound accurate?
Sounds good to me.
Sounds good. Well, have a great Monday. Thanks for listening, and we will be back next week.